met with Jerry Calder?
I have. Yeah.
He's quite the character.
Yeah, he's a great guy with a great story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but a lot of great stories. And you've got a good one.
You were there
at the very beginning of commercial biotech.
I was, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I hadn't really thought much about it until you contacted me there. Well, I had thought about it, but I haven't.
I went down to Pacific Grove and talked to Nils Reimers about it.
Yeah, I saw he was, you talked with him in one of the articles.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, he is a great guy.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. I only was really worked with him for a year, well, maybe not even a year. But
spoke very highly.
Did he?
Yeah,
good. Well, he's a great guy. He really made that technology licensing office at Stanford, which has been very successful for years. Not just the clone lawyer patent, but a lot of other
stuff. Sure. No, we talked about a lot of different stuff that he was involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Some digital audio technology was one of the biggest, bigger than the clone lawyer.
Right. That was, I think, before I got there, that was had been licensed, I think, and was generating some money.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Well, what we'd like to do is record a professional biography of you, and that fits into the broader history that we're compiling.
Okay.
So maybe we could start with some background. Where are you from originally?
I'm from the Chicago area, northern suburbs of Chicago, and I went to undergraduate at Purdue, and graduated with a chemical engineering degree from there in 1975.
Well, let me ask you about your family background then, and how you got interested in engineering.
Well, my father was a chemical engineer, and he worked for most of his career at Abbott Labs.
Okay, Northbrook, is that
close? No, it was North Chicago is where
North
the
Chicago.
Headquarters were, and they kind of... he was involved in really the building of Abbott Park, which is now their headquarters, which is, I don't think that's quite North Chicago. It's kind of between North Chicago and Libertyville, which is where I live in Hudsonville. But, he became head of engineering, vice president of engineering at Abbott, and really was responsible for the infrastructure for a lot of their expansion as their business expanded. So that's how I got probably exposed to chemical engineering, is because I...
Did it make an impression on you what your dad was doing?
Not so much. I knew what engineering was, and I liked and was good at math and science in high school, so I decided to go into chemical engineering. And, I was getting ready to graduate and looking for a job. I was interested in the pharmaceutical industry, probably because of his background, but also just to... It seemed like an interesting industry to me. I had interned, summer job for G.D. Searle between my junior and senior year. And that's where I ended up ultimately going to work out of college, was for G.D. Searle.
Yeah, what was the substance of Purdue's a top school in engineering? What was the substance of the program there?
Well, they didn't have any life science focus back then. Yeah. It was basically a generic chemical engineering degree is what I received. I did audit a couple courses in the pharmacy school. They had a very good pharmacy school, so my last... I could have graduated a semester early, but I used to race sailboats at the time, and I was on the sailing team for Purdue, which you don't think of them as being...
Cornfield.
Well, that's right. There's a small lake nearby.
Okay.
So I sailed for their university and competed against schools in the Midwest. So I wanted to do that for the final semester. And so I ended up auditing, I remember, at least one.
You sailed down here, by the way?
I did. I used to. I've switched over to golf, but I used to race out of Mission Bay. I remember taking a course in pharmaceutical unit operations, which is like tableting, encapsulating, those kind of things, just to kind of get some exposure to the industry.
And your dad approved of all this? Did you discuss it with him?
I'm sure we did, but he wasn't really a helicopter dad, at that time. He was more leading by example, I would say, than doing a lot of coaching. I ended up getting job offers from G.D. Searle, from Eli Lilly, and from Upjohn. The only only one left standing is Lilly today.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Lilly's right down the road.
Right.
And where was Searle at?
Searle was in Skokie, Illinois. In
Okay.
Suburb of Chicago.
Closer,
yeah, that's where I ended up going to work. And that was probably more to do with my sailing interest. I was racing sailboats at the time. Sailing at Lake Michigan was a lot better than sailing at a small lake near Indianapolis or Kalamazoo, Michigan. There was just a small lake.
So Uptown was the other one?
Uptown was the other one, yeah. So I worked for 4 years at Searle as an engineer. And first 2 years was a project engineering role. The second 2 years was more process engineering. We were kind of analyzing different processes and getting what will involve in the economics.
What was the first part? It was
Project engineering was the first 2 years. Well, that's if there's a project, like you need to install a new reactor. Well, somebody had to manage that project, which means working with the design firm that might be designing it, working with purchasing to get all the pieces of equipment necessary that need to be ordered, and then working with the trades that would do the installation, and sort of keeping the whole schedule and managing the project, if you will.
That's a good operational experience.
Right, right. It was. Got a broad exposure there. Well, I remember the first thing that dawned on me, though, when I have a pump. Well, I brought out the books. I was going to spec out a pump. Well, the senior engineer said, no. Just call a pump manufacturer, bring them in, and tell them what you need, and they'll do all that for you. So I realized it's you don't have to do everything yourself there. You can rely on the experts.
Yeah.
So, but during that sort of tenure, I did get some fermentation exposure. Searle had bought an old fermentation plant over in Hunter Beach, Michigan.
Yeah, what were the years here?
It was from 75 to 79, so I was there for 4 years.
And Searle during those years got mixed up with Genex, right? Did you have any contact?
No, that was probably after that, I think.
Yeah,
there was no
was
real
after.
Discussion right. Yeah. of biotech at that time. I didn't even know the word until I got out to the Stanford.
So you did that for...
I did some fermentation work at this plant, helping look at heat exchangers and that kind of thing. But so I knew what fermentation was and had some exposure there. But I decided that I really didn't want to be an engineer the rest of my life. I wanted to be involved in the business side where decisions were being made, because I felt as an engineer I would provide a lot of information to some business people and they would have to make the decisions. And we were really just providing input. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to get an MBA and applied to Harvard and Stanford, and got rejected at Harvard and accepted at Stanford, which was good because Stanford was my first choice anyway. But so I went out to there in 79, fall of 79. And
so Stanford was your first choice, right?
Well,
California or?
No, not necessarily. At that time, Harvard was teaching all their courses through case study. And like University of Chicago would be my third choice. I didn't, it was kind of my default. And they were doing no case study. Stanford was doing a mix. Some courses case study and some courses like statistics or accounting were just conventional lecture and textbook. And so I decided, well, why not do a blend of those two instead of just, because I'd done pretty well learning the traditional way through the engineering program. I didn't know if case study was necessarily, I wanted to jump in there full bore. So that was sort of my thinking.
And how did that turn out?
Well, it worked out really well for me. But
the case study...
The case study was fine. It was good to get exposure to that, but I don't think it's the right way to teach, or the most efficient way to teach a statistics course or an accounting course, those kind of things. But it's very useful for marketing, for example, or maybe some more general business courses. But I didn't go into Stanford thinking I was going to focus on the biotechnology or anything like that, as I wasn't even really aware of it. But when I was there, I started reading about it in the local papers. Genentech had gotten started, and Cetus, so it was really number two local.
People were talking about it?
Yeah, well, in the newspapers, they were talking about it, yeah. And then at the university, there was a little exposure to it as well. I ended up taking I forget what it was called, either a small business or an entrepreneurial class from Fitz Johnson, who was a guest teacher there. And so he brought people in. And
so what are the years here? Because he's
79 through I graduated in 81.
So he had gotten started in with HyberTech and was involved in Amgen.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what happened. The project for the course was to develop a business plan. That was really the whole course was based on that. So I had hooked up with a couple of other classmates, and we developed a business plan for a company in the diagnostic field. I forget exactly what our premise was, but so, you know, I got some interaction with Pitch on that, and then I talked with him about what I wanted to do, was get involved in a small biotech company. And, you know, Stanford has a lot of opportunities, too. I remember having a lunch or a dinner with Tom Perkins of Kleiner Perkins, who was Genentech and all that, and it was got to talk with him a little bit about it, too. And I had decided I kind of wanted to get into biotech, and I ended up auditing a biochemistry course and a molecular biology course in the undergraduate part there, just so I could speak the language a little better, because we didn't have any of that at Purdue.
Right.
Didn't even have biochemistry. We just had chemistry, organic chemistry was closest to chemistry to it. So that provided some background. And then it is interesting because through Pitch Johnson, I believe, I had actually an interview with George Rathman. And my father knew George Rathman as well because he came out of Abbott. So whether that helped me or not, but I think it was Pitch Johnson's. And it was kind of an interesting story because Amgen was originally going to locate in Thousand Oaks, kind of area where they thought about it. They were kind of a strange startup at the time. It was heresy almost, because they raised $20 million in venture capital before they even had a company. And George Rathman, and a scientist out of UCLA, I think, I forget his name, but
Winston Salser.
That's right. Yeah.
Talk to him. He's also interesting.
Yeah, he was a character, and he was a little controversial at the time. And so I went down there. They had set up rented some temporary space, and went down and interviewed there. And he said, you know, our pacing item here is we got to hire some scientists. We're having a little trouble hiring them to come to Thousand Oaks. And so he said, you know, we may have to make a change here. So put you on hold, you know.
They have to move the company.
Yeah. And he said, so Andy, I don't know, you know, you might have a role as our finance guy early on, or as our, he called it marketing, but as business development position. So I, you know, it sounded interesting, but then he did tell me we're going to take a time out here because we may have to locate the company up in the Bay Area or someplace else so we can hire scientists.
That's interesting.
So the other thing that happened at the same time, and again, this must have been Pitch Johnson's contact as well, I think, was I interviewed with Sam Ellender, who was the founder of Applied Biosystems. So, and that was different for me because it wasn't really a chemical engineering background. I didn't seem to have a lot to apply there.
But it turned out it would have.
But I was an instrument company, and I was interested in it. But I can't remember what happened. I didn't get the job, or I think again it wasn't moving along, and I was graduating, and I said I need to do something here.
Did George Rathman offer you a job?
Well, he told me that he thought there'd be a job for me here once you figure out where they're going to end up and what they're, because he took a time out of the whole thing there. So there was no formal offer, really, but it was pretty encouraging.
Yeah.
So it was about that time, though, that I saw something at the university for the technology licensing office position that Neil Frymers had. And they had a tradition there of hiring a business school student on a one-year kind of a contract assignment to work on certain projects, just general licensing things. But this seemed unique to me because it was the Combe-Boyer patent, which, again,
did
I wasn't aware of. Well, I didn't realize it until I got in and talked with him, and he explained to me what it was, and it was kind of a groundbreaking patent, and they had a very unique licensing program that he envisioned doing here. So, you know, it was sort of a flyer because all my other classmates were out taking real jobs with companies and all that, here I would take a one-year assignment with Technology Licensing Office at Stanford. But I decided it would probably be a pretty good springboard into biotech, because I would get to talk to a lot of the biotech companies. They'd be interested in the license, and I would learn about patents, and I would learn about licensing, which I didn't really know much about at the time. There's no business school courses in any of those areas. So anyway, that's what I ended up doing. Now, in hindsight, maybe I should have held on, and if Rathman would have come through with a job, Amgen would have been getting in at the ground floor there. Would have been pretty good, assuming I could have stuck with it and held all the stock until I was going to left. But anyway, that didn't happen. But I think I made a very good choice, because it was a really unique assignment there at Stanford, and it was very kind of baptism by fire, because you had to learn very quickly about patents and licensing, and I worked with, Bert Rowland was the patent attorney that did the Kohn-Boyer patent and prosecuted it. And there was still a little cleanup going on, as I recall. They had the patents that issued, but there was some maybe international patents or something. But we talked with him, and then the other guy that was involved was Aldo Test, who was a patent attorney but more of a business advisor to Niels. And he's the guy that we talked to about legal issues relating to the licensing agreement. So I learned a lot about licensing from him and from Niels.
Was the plan formulated at that time? Because the way Niels explained it to me, it evolved over time.
It did evolve over time, yeah. He had the concept of non-exclusive, low royalty rate, but requiring something up front from the companies. But I believe that was pretty much what he had envisioned when I got there. Nothing was really put on paper, or very little. So that was sort of my job, was to put something on paper in a license agreement, and come up with a marketing strategy, if you will, how we're going to contact all these companies. And so, you know, he deserves most of the credit, but I was involved more in the implementation of it. So worked with the lawyer to get the license drafted. We came up with the provisions of, I think it was $10,000 up front and $10,000 annual fee.
How did you arrive at that figure?
Well, it was a wild ass guess. Basically, we wanted something that was not ridiculously expensive, but something that was a meaningful amount. So, and we were hoping to get several dozen companies signed up. And then the whole strategy was, we get enough signed up, a critical mass, that it would be difficult for others to challenge. Because, you know, we're kind of worried about people challenging it. It was kind of a controversial patent at the time. And
right.
Controversial.
There were some controversies on campus. Had that all blown over by the time?
That had pretty much blown over, yeah. There was no, I don't remember there being any resistance there.
And what did the industry people say about it? Because this is what I've been told, that you've got there's some collusion. You know, some people say, well, we should challenge this patent. And, you know, it's a large group of people. Maybe they're already licensees or saying, no, this is a good deal. We're not paying very much for it.
Right. Well, I didn't hear any of that, but most of the companies, you know, had lots of questions about it. Some complained. Genentech wanted sort of a special deal. I remember Niels and I had lunch at the 11th hour, you know, a few days before the deadline, with Tom Kiley, who was their attorney.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was Bob Swanson, too. And, you know, they were kind of putting the heavy lean on us to try to get a deal.
What kind of leverage did they have?
Well, they didn't really have any. They were just Genentech, and they had an inventor there. And so we just had decided we were going to hold firm. But we had spent a lot of time trying to figure out, there were different royalty rates depending on the type of product. If it was an end product, like a pharmaceutical drug, the royalty rate was like a 1% going to a 0.5%, I think, depending on volume. And then, but if it was a bulk product, meaning an intermediate, it was a different royalty rate. If it was a research tool, it was a different research rate. So we had, I think it was four categories, if I remember right. And we had examples put together for all that. And that was sort of the materials that I took with me when I went out to the companies. And we had done some economic analysis, too. So it was and then we had I think it was Neil's idea. Well, let's get the license printed up. Let's just not have it on 8.5 by 11 paper. So we had it printed up and bound. It was a booklet type thing. So it looked like it was a take it or leave it thing. We weren't intending to negotiate with each company. So we wanted to make it, you know, one size fits all type of a thing there. And I think that helped. So then I literally went around the world marketing this thing, because I think I other, in addition to the U.S., and many of the U.S. companies came to visit us, so we could travel around to other U.S. companies. But we also, I went to Japan, and that was really interesting because they were very excited over there. Biotech was a big thing, and so the press was involved. The press found out I was coming, and so they... I got interviewed by the press. I was on Japanese TV a little bit. And I would, the trading companies organized a lot of the meetings. They'd bring companies in their group. And so I'd go into a room and there'd be like 20 or 30 of these elderly Japanese guys sitting around this humongous table. And I'd have a little presentation I went through and they would ask questions. And I did that in several cities and times there. And then I took a trip through Europe. 2 week trip almost through there, visiting a lot of the companies. You know, not just small biotech companies, but chemical companies, big pharma companies, all different types of companies.
It must have been a lot of fun.
It was. It was a very interesting. I did that those trips on my own. I did all the trips pretty much on my own, so it was just kind of me out there thrown into it.
So you're learning the university licensing game.
Right.
Did you ever have any thoughts of, hey, I could do something in this area?
Well, I did thought I could do that, yeah. But I kind of wanted to get involved in the small companies, what I figured out that was kind of my goal going into it.
After the entrepreneurship class.
Right.
Did that make a big impression?
Well, that did, and the whole atmosphere at Stanford was very entrepreneurial. I think that's one of the things that really sets it apart. It would have been a lot different if I went to Harvard. I think just because Stanford, you're right in the middle of Silicon Valley there, it turned out to be a big biotech area as well. And so there's venture capitalists all over the place, and a number of my classmates went to work for venture firms.
Yeah, you, before going to Stanford, you didn't have a good idea of that, or did you?
I didn't, no.
And so that was a discovery.
Exactly.
Wow, there's a lot going on here.
Exactly. Yeah, back in the Midwest, you know, I didn't know what venture capital was. So that was, indeed what happened is we ended up signing up 73 companies, I think, right out of the shoot up by the deadline.
A lot of big corporations.
Big corporations, yeah, because there weren't as many small ones as there are now. Now there's a bazillion small ones. A few years later, there were a lot of them, but... back then, it was mostly larger companies.
Were there any notable absences that
there probably were, but I'm not sure I remember who they were. There were some I think we were surprised and disappointed they didn't do it. But they could always do it later.
Yeah.
You didn't have to do it. The reason to do it early is you got credits for these upfront payments you made, the $10,000. I believe you got like 5x that as a credit against future royalties. So there was a little bit of reward to get in early. And we also said the terms may change. We might change the royalties rates for later if you don't sign the deadline.
Have to stipulate?
We did stipulate that. I can't remember. Well, I left before. I don't know if they changed it at all or not. They may have. But sort of lost touch with it after a while. I had to become a licensee in some of my future companies. but anyway, what happened after that was, I was involved in doing some other licensing programs at Stanford, a couple of things, and I...
Were they life sciences or other?
Yeah. I remember Lupert Stryer, who was a researcher there, a biochemist, I think. He had some very interesting technology that was...
combinatorial chemistry types of things?
No, I remember it was sort of a fluorescent tags or something. Unique way of tagging things. And so I had gotten involved in that. And that's kind of what I was working on when I ended up leaving. I didn't get to finish that, I don't think. But I did get to talk to some other professors there. And it was, it's a university like Stanford, there's a lot of technology coming out there. They had such an active licensing program that the faculty there was tuned in, and if they had something of interest, they would usually contact the office, I think.
So it was the case that they were contacting you rather than you going out and asking, hey, what do you have?
Well, I think by the time I got there, that's true. I think in Niels's early days, he had to do more of the going out and trying to figure, shake the labs, if you will, and see what was going on. But it was pretty well known by the time I was there. A lot of the professors would contact us if they had any Well, they would. There was the patent office at Stanford. They had a patenting group that was separate from the licensing, and that we worked with them. In fact, Kathy Koo, who took over for Niels as head of the licensing office, she came from the patenting side.
Yes.
So if a researcher there had something he thought might be patentable, they would usually contact the, as I recall, the patent department there at Stanford, and they would then usually work with outside counsel to get something working. And then the licensing group would find out about that, try to make some assessment whether we thought there's any commercial potential there. But what happened there, Aldo Tess, the lawyer that was helping us with the license, he was actually advising some scientists up in Seattle that were starting a company that at the time was called Zymos. It became Zymogenetics later on. So he was working with Ben Hall and Earl Davies and Smith, the other guy was from Vancouver. But
right.
So
he was a Nobel Prize winner. Yeah.
Smith was.
Was he at that time?
I don't think he was at that time. What was his first name? Anyway. But they had started. I'll think of it here. He's kind of a crazy guy.
Was he?
Yeah. And he was the least of the three that was interested in doing the company. He was kind of just going along, I think, because it was kind of fashionable at the time. He didn't put much time in it. Well, the company was in Seattle, and he was up in Vancouver, so he was out of the loop a little bit. But anyway, so Aldo was working with these guys, and they were looking for some.
He's in
Palo Alto.
Palo Alto.
Right. And so.
How was that connection?
I'm not sure how he got hooked up with them. I think maybe they were looking for someone to help them with patents and licensing, and so they worked with Aldo's firm. He did patent. His firm wrote patents as well.
So, nationally?
Yeah. Well, the firm was Flair, Hobach, and Test, so I don't think it was national. It was just well-known on the West Coast. But so Aldo had recommended me then. He said, well, you ought to go up and talk to these guys. They're looking for someone to develop a business plan and to manage the company. And I said, that's kind of what I'm hoping to do. So I ended up meeting with the three founders there. And
so they're just three academics, that's it?
Right.
At that point?
Yeah, they had, they had a lab outside the university. The company was incorporated. And they had a couple of postdocs that were working for the company, I believe, when I moved up there, but maybe when I got involved. But
so they had help from somebody, from an attorney?
Well, Aldo. Yeah, he kind of said he was really their advisor. And so I decided I was going to do that, and I was still working at technology licensing, but in my spare time I was writing their initial business plan. And
why did you think, okay, this is the opportunity? There must have been others at that point.
Well, there might have been others, but this was a startup. This was an early stage, and these guys were really high-powered scientists. Ben Hall was a world expert in yeast. Earl Davies was an expert in blood proteins.
Yeah.
And Michael Smith was an expert in enzymes, I believe.
Restriction enzymes?
Yeah, maybe something like that. But
I forget.
So anyway, it just sounded good, and it sounded like a good opportunity, and Seattle sounded like an interesting place. And I don't know. I mean, it wasn't like I had three or four things to choose from. This one kind of... Because that was before I was done with my year at Stanford. I wasn't... That's why I was kind of writing a business plan while I was there, and then I had wanted to talk to Niels and told him I'd got this opportunity, and would he mind if I left a few months early, which I ended up doing. So,
what were the technical projects that they were proposing?
Well, Ben Hall thought, but back at that time there was big concern. There was E. coli, is the expression system of choice, I guess.
He's a yeast guy.
He's a yeast guy, and a lot of these proteins need to be glycosylated, the sugar groups on them, and E. coli couldn't do that. And at that time, he couldn't really work with a million cells that had gotten that far. So yeast was sort of intermediate. It could do some glycosylation, right? So that was one advantage. The other thing that Earl Davies was a blood protein guy, and he had a blood protein factor 8 or something that he was involved with. And he had several other ones that were unique that had come out of his research. So those were the initial technology that got me. When I got in there, we did a couple of things. We raised some money, venture money. Cable House from Seattle, they put the...
They're putting money in a number of different Seattle companies.
Yeah. Right, yeah. But they put it in there. I don't remember who else was in there. They might have been the only initial money in there. But I was able to negotiate a couple of collaborations, one with Novo out of Denmark, who wanted to produce its insulin in yeast. And so they were...
Had anybody done insulin?
No, not at that time. And so, Genentech had done it with, or was doing it with Lilly, but it was E. coli-based, I think. Yeah. And Novo wanted to do it in yeast, so they were impressed with Ben Hall's yeast expertise. And so we negotiated a research contract with them. They put a fair amount of money in. And they might have bought some equity too at the time. So I negotiated that.
Tell me a little bit about Ben Hall and Earl Davies. I think Earl Davies is really old now. I don't
know.
Well,
Ben Hall's maybe not quite as old.
Well, I talked to him on the phone. I haven't been up there yet, but I need to go talk to him. He said he'd talk to me if I go up. So
Ben Hall?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what were your impressions of these guys? These solid guys?
They're very solid guys. Now, Ben Hall, I was only there a year, and it turned out I got crossways with Ben Hall. So if you ask him about me, I'd be interested in what he would say now. But he had his wife, who was a school teacher, elementary school teacher, I believe, was helping out with the company. None of these guys left their university positions. They didn't come, so they were kind of advisors.
And the plan was that they would not, and they would not. You would put together both.
Right. And they would bring some scientists in, which they did. We had some postdocs that were working there. We had full-time scientists when I was up there. But it got to the point, we had the Novo deal. We had a contract with Eisai, the Japanese company. I think it was for a blood protein. And we were negotiating with Cooper Labs, who was interested in alpha-1 antitrypsin, which is lung enzyme that had huge potential for treating some sort of emphysema or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was a target. But anyway, and we were hiring people and... So we needed to have a financial person, and Ben Hall's wife had been handling the checkbook nearly as well. We were kind of getting beyond the needs of the checkbook.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to hire a financial person, so it wasn't really a role for her anymore that I saw. It was nice for her to help out. And Ben said, well, maybe she should be a human resource person. I didn't think we needed a human resource person at that stage, but I probably could have handled it better. He could have handled it better, but he got all irritated because I wouldn't keep his wife on. And so he said, it's either Andy goes or I go, and he's Ben Hall, and I'm an MBA out of Stanford. So I left, was asked to leave. So that was after about a year. So it was a tough pill to swallow at the time because I thought I had done this. Well, it was recognized that I'd done a lot of good things. But
yeah, so establishing these partnerships, that's huge. That's what's keeping the thing afloat.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
So how was it at that time negotiating with these companies?
Well, it was interesting, and it turned out it was something that I turned out to be pretty good at. I did a lot of that over the years at Mycogen and stuff, so this is something that I didn't have a lot of experience at the time because these were the only ones I'd done, but I was again working with Aldo Test, was the advisor, the lawyer on that side, so we negotiated those deals and were able to get a better deal than Novo was originally offering. So Ben Hall said, we really appreciate what you did here, but I can't have you working here anymore. So that was a tough one for me. But Earl Davies was a gentleman through the whole time, really a smart guy, and had level-headed guy. His son was working at the company, but he was sort of a facilities guy. There weren't a lot of computers back then, but in terms of ordering equipment and that kind of thing, he was fine. He stayed on with the company. And I'd say those three guys were really the advisory board of the company. And we had a number of scientists on their labs for doing the work, and hired technicians. I'm not sure. We might have had a dozen people working there when I left, probably. Had an office manager, rest were scientists. But it was very interesting to me. Again, I learned a lot about researchers interacting with the multinational companies and that kind of thing. And it turned out, again, who knows? I mean, Novo ended up buying the company.
Yeah.
They had to change their name to Zymo Genetics because we had Zymos was a semiconductor company at the time in the Bay Area, and they didn't like the fact we had the same name, even though we were in different industries. So their name became Zymo Genetics. And I had a little stock that they invested, and so when Novo bought the company, I just paid a little bit of money, as I recall. That was not that long after I left. I think it was probably 2 or 3 years after I left. And then Novo ran it as an independent research company for a while, and then they spun it back out again. And I'm not sure what.
I don't think it exists anymore.
I think they reabsorbed.
I think it was Novo again.
I think they did. But I know that Novo's yeast production, or Novo's enzyme, or insulin production was in that, from the yeast work that was done by Dan Hall there. And they came up with the blood protein out of Earl Davies' work that I believe was commercialized, if not by Novo, by someone else. So there was really good science there. And
so this is 1982-ish?
Yeah, it was early. I left there.
Did you have a place to go?
No, I didn't have a place to go. It was kind of interesting. I decided, well, all right, you know, I'd like to get involved with another small company. But I said, you know, maybe there's some other applications for biotechnology outside of the pharmaceutical area. Because at that time, there had already been a number of companies. Little did I know, or very naively, that since then there's been dozens, if not 100 more, pharmaceutical-oriented biotech companies. But back then, there seemed to be a bunch. So I said, well, what are some other potential applications? And
So you're thinking this is getting a little crowded?
Yeah, maybe? I did. That was kind of, it turned out to be kind of ridiculous. But so I decided, well, I'll go back down and start talking to some venture capitalists and see if they had some companies. And I remember I went to talk to Cetus. And
who did you talk to then?
It was Pete Farley. I don't know if Ron Cape was there. He was there at the time, I don't know. But I interviewed with them and other companies. But I thought maybe there's a way to use biotechnology in wine making. I remember I had kind of that idea. I did some research into that, but I couldn't figure much out there. But anyway, some venture capitalist, it might have been Fitch Johnson's partner, the younger guy.
Brooke Byers has worked with them for a while.
That was after that.
Yeah.
Anyway, somebody suggested, well, you ought to talk to this guy, David Ramler, who's with Vanguard Venture Partners. And he's a PhD biochemist, and he's become a venture capitalist, and he's got a lot of ideas for starting things. So I contacted him and went in to see him. He had an office there in Sand Hill Road. And he said, you know, funny you should mention this, because I've just been thinking about using biotechnology to develop alternatives to chemical pesticides. I said, well, that's interesting.
Where did that idea come from?
It came out of his there was concern over chemical pesticides back then, and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Zoecon was doing, and Ramler was. He knew of those guys. He knew John Diekman. He knew Carl Grassi. He knew Alex Zaffaroni. He knew who those guys were. But I don't know. And maybe that had something to do with it. But he just had that idea. And I said, well, that's interesting. Let me look into it a little bit. And so I did. And I, you know, it's a big industry, I found out. Yeah, kind of both sides were under pressure, so I sent it. And then a scientist kind of came into Rambler's office, not the same day, but around the same time, a guy named Dave Edwards, who was living in San Diego, UCSD, I think. And he was doing some consulting for Vanguard on a different project of Rambler, and so he got exposed to the idea, and he thought it was sort of interesting. And so David Rambler didn't have a business plan, or he had a business plan on a piece of paper, and he wasn't capable of really writing a business plan. He was a really smart guy, but he didn't have a discipline to write anything down. But he had one concept, which was to go out onto plants and find out what the bacteria, the microflora was that are on plant leaves, right, that live there.
And then this is his idea.
His idea. And then genetically engineer them.
Oh, he's a biochemist.
He's a biochemist, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Engineer them to produce a protein that's toxic to insects. And then you recolonize the plant with that population of microbes.
And did he know about BT?
Yeah, he knew about BT. Back there, there was like one strain of BT, one protein. So that was his concept, and so we filed a patent on that. He was one of the inventors on that. But so anyway, I decided to go ahead and do it. I was up in Seattle at the time. Dave Edwards was down here. Rambler was in Menlo Park. So we decided where we were going to locate the company. And Menlo Park already, or in that area, Bay Area had a lot of companies. We thought it might be harder to recruit scientists there. Also, it wasn't really an ag area. Seattle didn't make a lot of sense. It wasn't an ag area. Now,
there's the Silicon Valley is not too far to ag.
No, it's not. But that was kind of our thinking. It wasn't really ag. And down here in San Diego, it wasn't really ag, but there was a lot of horticulture industry. We thought maybe horticulture would be our place we would start. It's kind of some of the thinking that went into that. And it's a nice area to live. We could attract scientists here. You know, there was Hybertech was here at the time, but it really wasn't
did
much.
You know out. About them? Did you?
I knew about them. Yeah. So we decided to locate the company here. Vanguard put up the initial venture capital, which I think was $300,000. Dave Edwards and I got 10% of the company, and Vanguard got 80%. We started. So we set up, rented some temporary space down near UTC there, and I ended up writing a business plan.
Were there any other companies there at that time?
No. We were just, nobody knew what biotech was other than Hybertech. I don't think there was any other biotech companies. And so I called over to Hybertech, and I remember asking them, you know, who do you use for your auditor? Who do you use for this or that?
So who did you talk to?
I talked with, I remember Martha Dembski, who was their chief financial officer at the time. Ted Green, I remember talking with several times as well. But I remember Martha Dembski is the one that I probably maybe didn't talk a lot with technically. It was how to get stuff organized. Right.
And they thought it was a good idea to have other people coming in doing stuff.
Well, they didn't care. We weren't in their field. Right. So, they didn't. And they were just helpful. They were sort of kindred spirits there.
Yeah.
Small company, something that they had already been through. So they were willing to help out, which I think most companies are willing to do that. So we ended up hiring a scientist or two and had a temporary lab down in...
From San Diego?
From San Diego. Frank Gartner was the first scientist hired. He was the guy Dave Edwards knew. Dave Edwards never really did a lot of science. He was very good at explaining scientific things to investors and recruiting other scientists, but I don't remember him doing a lot of work in the lab. Frank Gartner was the first kind of bench.
Where did he come from?
Frank Gartner?
UCSD or Salk?
It might have been Salk.
Yeah.
But it was here locally.
Yeah.
And he brought his technician. We hired her as well. And they set up a temporary lab. Dave Edwards had a bunch of equipment, I remember, that was left over from a grant. It was kind of a funny thing. The grant had paid for it all. The grant ran out. So basically he owned the equipment. So we took that into the company. So we kind of had a lab we could move in and purchased a few things. And then we, based on the business plan, we raised, I kind of remember $1.5 million. It's probably close, from three other venture capitalists. One was Cable House Reagan out of Seattle, because they had more experience with me. Well, they also knew David Rambler as well, so they were obviously comfortable with me, or they wouldn't have invested. And I think either that round or another round, Bill Bowes from U.S. Venture Partners might have been in that first round, might have been the next round. They were involved. I can remember the other ones. And Vanguard put some more money in as well.
We've got the IPO perspective, so we
can check that out. So then we set up, we leased some space in what has become the Mira Mesa Business Park there. We were one of the first companies to lease space in there. Now it's a huge, giant area, you know, mostly Qualcomm, but yeah. We were down there on Oberlin Drive. And my role is I was vice president of operations. Dave Edwards was VP of science or technology. Rambler was the initial president. We had a part-time guy.
He's up in Menlo Park.
He was on the board of directors, never really got actively involved. He had a guy that he brought in, a guy named Don Eaton, who was not a biotech guy, but had been president of companies in the past, and so they appointed him to be president of the company early on. And he wasn't located here either, but he was kind of an advisor to me and to others. He was on the board. And so we set about trying to reduce to practice this Rambler concept. We called it biological packaging, I think. We did.
And all the scientists you talked to looked at it and said, yeah, this could work.
We had different types of scientists. We had entomologists because we're trying to kill insects. We had, the other technology we had was using plant pathogens, pathogenic microorganisms, usually fungi, to act as bioherbicides to take out weeds. So there was no genetic engineering involved there. We just identified these. Our universities identified them, we licensed them, that could then be produced on a large scale through fermentation, formulated in a way that keep them alive, and then you spray them on a crop and try to take out a weed very selectively without damaging the others, biopesticide. Mm-hmm. That never turned out to be commercially relevant, but we spent a fair amount of effort on it. That was our other platform. We had the biological packaging.
Yeah.
And we had this, and that's why it was Microgen was the name of the company, because Michael was fungi.
So that was the main thrust initially?
Well, no, there were the two thrusts.
Yeah.
But one of them we thought was going to be quicker because there was no genetic engineering involved.
More regulatory
obstacles. The other was sexy, but regulatory obstacles and unproven science. But we were able to pretty quickly, with Frank Gartner doing the molecular genetics, we first isolated Pseudomonas fluorescensis, probably the most prevalent bacteria on leaf surfaces. And it had a pigmented cell wall to protect its own internal DNA. So we thought that would be good for protecting our protein that's going to be in there. And we isolated some strains of that, and then Frank figured out how to genetic engineer it, and we put a BT protein in there and sprayed it back on plants in a greenhouse up in Encinitas, and introduced some caterpillars, and lo and behold, the leaves were fine, and the caterpillars died, and it was very...
Was it difficult to get permission to do that?
Well, not an enclosed space. The next step was going to be difficult. And
Before we go there, I just want to ask, how did this opportunity feel to you in comparison to Xylem Genetics? The difference, they're working on stuff, potentially pharmaceuticals.
Well, I thought the timelines we were hoping would be shorter here. The drug thing was going to take forever, require lots of money. We were hoping that this would be quicker to market and require less investment. But there was a lot of uncertainty there, and I didn't have much familiarity with the pesticide industry, and that's what led us to getting Gary Calder in there. Our plan was to get the company up to a certain level, at least proof of concept, some technology-wise, and then we could recruit someone in from the pesticide industry, someone that had experience there. And so Jerry came in after, the company was up and going about 15, 18 months or so before Jerry got involved. And so I was I'm working with the headhunter, the recruiter, to find someone, and Jerry was one of the ones we interviewed, and he stood up.
And how was the role defined?
He was going to be chairman, CEO, or CEO anyway, maybe not chairman, but CEO. I was going to be VP of operations, the operating guy. But we needed someone, if we were going to raise more money and really get a pesticide through the EPA, we needed somebody out of that industry with the experience and a little clout.
I forget the details of Jerry's story. My recollection is he told me great stories about, you know, doing stuff in Central America and all that stuff. But he was doing business development things, right?
Business development. He has a technical background, obviously. So he would, what did they call it? They called it commercial development at Monsanto. That was their term for taking product from research, as interfacing research and the market. There was commercial development where they would do the equivalent of clinical trials, but doing field testing. So that's what he was responsible for, I think, and doing it in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
You know, Roundup was the big product there. So,
but
he really stood out as, and Monsanto at the time was, you know, getting involved in the biotech side of it too. So he had that background. So his resume was really good, as far as I was concerned. And we're very excited that we were able to get him out of Monsanto.
Well, what did it take to get him out?
Well, I think he wanted to run something, you know, he wanted to run something, and he wasn't going to run Monsanto, at least for quite a while. And, you know, he got an equity chunk in the company. I don't remember the details at the time.
But he was ready to go.
Yeah. So I remember meeting him up face-to-face at a conference in San Francisco. He was out there representing Monsanto, and I flew up, and that was the initial interview. And he's heard me tell us it was ironic because he was very serious during that kind of dour, and that was one thing when Rambler and Eaton asked me, well, yeah, he's really a sharp guy, impressive, you know, he's kind of pretty serious, so I don't know how much, you know, but it turns out he's a real character, he's anything but serious, so he joined us there, and moved to San Diego with his wife and his son, and took over running the company. And what happened, you know, the whole regulatory thing was a question. It's how we were going to get a live release of a live genetic engineered microorganism. So actually, it was my idea. The patent, we decided, we were talking one day, well, it was, you know, we want to colonize these leaf surfaces to protect the plant, and we want the bacteria to protect the protein, so the protein didn't get denatured out there in UV light and all those things. So, well, why don't we engineer the Pseudomonas fluorescens, grow them up in a fermenter, mass produce them, and then kill them? And we're not releasing any live genetically engineered organisms, but we've got the cell wall still protecting the protein.
Doesn't the cell wall start to break down?
Well, that's was one thing, and so one of the scientists said, well, but there's technology for that, fixing the cell wall. Well, they fix cells all the time for staining them, and, you know, I guess for assay purposes and stuff, and so there's treatments that you can fix the cell wall, meaning polymerize the polymers in the cell wall. And we had to find one that would do that without damaging the RBT protein, so we did. Sue Cummings was her name, and she and I were the inventors on the, we call the cell cap patents, which that was the trade name we came up with. It was cell cap, which was...
Yeah, I noticed your name is on a lot of these patents.
Right. So, well, those two anyway. Maybe there's international ones. But so that's really became the technology that we commercialized. So we never commercialized the biological packaging concept the Rambler had because of regulatory concerns. And I don't think that probably would even apply today. With the cell cap, we had to convince the EPA that we could kill all the cells, and we were able to do that. We did it in the fermenter after the fermentation was complete, kill all the cells. And they indeed were fairly hardy little biocapsules, and the insect's digestive system would break down the cell wall, and then the protein would kill them. So, you know, it was very clever and kind of sexy technology that was easy to explain to Wall Street and investors and that. And so that was our delivery system, and then we set about finding other proteins that would kill different types of insects, because the original BT protein was only good for caterpillars, certain types of caterpillars. So we had a program where we would get soil samples or samples from all over the place, and then bring them to the lab and analyze them for BT of different strains, and then look for the...
It wasn't just random, though. I mean, you're looking for... You're taking soil samples from where the pests are? Is that...
Well, you did some of that. Some of it was random. Some, you know, they're strange places, you know, grain elevators, and then all that stuff. I wasn't in charge of where it was, but it was different. All sorts of places, different parts of the world, etc. But we wanted different BT strains, so we built up a big library of BT strains, and then they have entomologists who rear different types of insects, and then we'd have to develop assays to feed them to see if we could be toxic to these insects or that. And so we found quite a variety, and that became Mycogen's probably crown jewel, was the BT collection, and then subsequently the genes responsible for the individual protein there, and we filed patents on those, and that became our real asset. And we did end up commercializing several products to spray on cell cap products. One for caterpillars, one for certain beetles, Colorado potato beetle being one of them, or several others. But it became clear that we were limited there, because you had to keep applying it. While the cell cap protected the protein better than just a regular BT strain, it would wash off with rain. You know, it had similar problems that regular spray-on pesticides would have. And so fortunately, science was evolving so that you could genetically engineer the plants so they could produce foreign proteins. And also serendipitously, one of our investors in around after Jerry was there, an investor, Lubrizol, had a venture group. It was feeling its oats because they were early investors in Genentech, so they had made a lot of money on that investment, and so they had a kind of a pretty free rein to make other biotech investments, and so they made a bunch of those, one of which was a company called AgriGenetics.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about that in detail, because I've talked to some of those people.
Yeah.
David Padua.
I think he was in a different one.
No, he was AgriGenetics.
Was he AgriGenetics?
Yeah.
AgriGenetics, it was an amorphous thing.
They had all these seed companies.
Yeah, they had seed companies, and they also had researchers, and that spun out of the old R&D limited partnership thing, where they raised a bunch of money from like movie stars and people, and so they could get the tax break.
Right.
And so they bought up all these little biotech seed companies and other things. They were going to do nitrogen fixing bacteria and all sorts of things. And Lubrizol was invested in that, and that kind of went bad for whatever reason. And Lubrizol ended up inheriting whatever was left there, I think, and there was lawsuits and all sorts of stuff that we weren't involved in, but we heard about because Lubrizol had invested in us and got on our board. And so Lubrizol was looking to kind of extricate itself from that whole thing, and you know, they were especially a lubricants company, and so biotech didn't necessarily fit there, and they probably had a new CEO on the time, and he had decided to... It was time to get out of that venture group, or maybe focus that venture group on things that were more central to their core business.
Yeah.
So it made sense to...
What did they have that you wanted?
Well, they had the ability to genetically engineer plants, and they had some seed companies. They didn't have a lot of seed companies at the time, but they had patents for expressing BT in plants. And they had the know how to do it. They had patents on some of the tools, some of the vectors, was it agrobacterium tumorfaction? They had some patents on that. They had intellectual property, which was to get into the plant genetic engineering game. You didn't have intellectual property to horse trade with, if nothing else.
Yeah. And another thing I wanted to ask you about was there was some patent trouble with, you had a BT patent, and was it Novo?
Well, we had several troubles. The one with what was it? Oh, well, we had discovered, one of our researchers had discovered a strain of BT that produced a protein toxic to that Colorado potato beetle.
Yeah, yeah.
And, well, the whole thing, I don't think we really know the full true story to it, but she had visited the lab of a researcher in Germany who had made a discovery also before.
Independently?
Yeah, she was from Germany. So she was back there and went in to see them. Independently, yes. And so she came back, and after she came back, she had discovered a strain herself that we thought was different than that strain. And so we went about sequencing the gene and patenting that and everything. We got a patent issue on that ourselves. And then we commercialized that product. Well, we were collaborating with Novo at the time. We needed fermentation capability.
Yeah.
And I had prior contacts with Novo from the Zymogenetics days. So they had an enzyme business. They had the insulin business, but they also were the leading producer of industrial enzymes. They knew how to produce stuff.
Were they making recombinant enzymes by that time?
I don't remember. Recombinant insulin at the time, but yeah. I don't know if they were doing the enzymes at the time. But so we had an agreement. I was traveling over there periodically because that was my responsibility, was the operations side of it. And we were going to have them produce this BT strain. Because we commercialized it first, we were going to just do the natural strain, and then we were going to follow it on with the cell cap version. And so they were working on it, and then they discovered that they thought the strain was the same as the German strain.
Who did?
Novo did. They were working with our strain, and then they had decided maybe they'll get into the biopesticide business because they had excess fermentation capacity. And so they went to that German researcher, that's how it was. Then they said, well, geez, you know, we think this is the same strain. It looks the same to us. And it's funny. So we got...
I'm sorry, Andrew. Hey, Brian, I'm in an interview. I'll call you back, okay? Can you hear me? Sorry. Are you there, Brian? Yeah, I'm in an interview. I'll call you back, all right? Okay, bye-bye.
So anyway, they ended up teaming up with the researcher, and I don't know if they brought a lawsuit or anything, they challenged our patent.
So this is a little kind of dirty business on Novo's part, huh? They want to...
Well, from ours, that was a conflict, but yeah, the fact they were getting into biopesticides was kind of irritating to us.
Yeah.
And... But they would say that we misappropriated the strain. They believed that our scientists had come in contact in the lab and had taken it out of there, intentionally or unintentionally. You know, these BT floating, or spores, they float around.
But you'd sequence, they'd sequence, put them, what happens when you put them together?
I don't know if they ever sequenced.
Oh.
You know, that researcher wasn't into that type of thing. So if they did, they did it after we did, because we wouldn't have got our patent. But anyway, there was a lawsuit, and we went back and forth for a while, and we ended up settling with them. Don't know. We had to pay them some money or something. Cross-license each other. So I think they commercialized it as well, maybe. It wasn't a big product for us anyway. Or maybe we dropped it. We went forward with the cell cap version of it. Maybe they did the natural version. But it soured that relationship with them. Which was disappointing. But that was the first of a number of patent issues, because we got in Monsanto's crosshairs, because they were trying to commercialize and develop transgenic crops as well, the BT resistance. And we had our BT collection, our number of genes, and then we had the agrogenetics technology and their intellectual property.
Yeah.
And so...
And Jerry Caller's tied into those networks. Yeah.
Right, so he knew all those guys over there. And so it was a little... it was helpful, but I think, you know, they looked at, you know, maybe we could stick it to Jerry here. You know, he left us. And Jerry was getting a lot of publicity because he was active. It was a strategy of ours. Well, you know, it'd be good for Micogen if we'd have a guy that would be active in BIO, the big biotech trade association. So Jerry was, I think he might have been head of BIO for a year or two, and was on the board and all that. So he was getting a fair amount of publicity and became a spokesman for Ag Biotech to a large extent because we were one of the leaders, as was Monsanto. And so I think that probably rubbed Monsanto the wrong way. You know, they were a big company, they don't seek the spotlight.
Well, how did you feel about this entire field that's sort of growing up? And you've got some, I guess, pharmaceuticals, you've got, you know, huge corporations populate that field, but they really didn't sort of take over the way Monsanto took over. Did you see that happening?
Well, we saw it as an opportunity because there was really only Monsanto and then there was us. Now DuPont was trying to get involved, and Pioneer Hybrid, it was the big dog seed company at the time. They weren't part of DuPont at the time, so we were talking about allying ourselves with Pioneer Hybrid and then competing against Monsanto because they were acquiring seed companies. We acquired some small seed companies, but nothing like they were able to do. And we were deciding we needed some partners if we were going to battle against Monsanto there. And we learned a lot. You know, having the technology is one thing, but you have to have the germplasm, you have to have high-yielding corn.
Or, did you have it?
Or? Well, we didn't have it, no. It couldn't compete with Pioneer. And DeKalb was the company that Monsanto ended up buying, who was the number two U.S. seed company at the time. And so we ended up doing a collaboration with Pioneer, where they wanted access to our BT library, and we were going to be paid royalties on their transgenic crops with our traits in them, and that we were going to also be able to commercialize those traits in our germplasm and our seed varieties that we sell, and we were a very small market share compared to them, but at least we have the technology on that. So it became a much more complicated larger dollar value game once we got into the transgenic crops.
Yeah.
And
you felt like this, you had to go this way.
We did, and then once we got a follow Monsanto, once we had the conflicts and we were suing each other there, we needed.
So what were the suits about?
Well, they were about ability to put BT in plants, because we believe we had the basic patents through Ag Genetics. They were the first ones to put in plants. Monsanto didn't think so. They didn't think the patents were valid. You know, the usual arguments about invalidity or who did what first.
Right.
It was very complicated. So one of the things, several things happened, Jerry. We brought in an attorney, Carl Eibel, in-house to help us because legal was going to be a bigger part of our business going forward. And then Carl got promoted to president of Micogen, I believe, and Jerry became CEO, chairman. Carl ultimately was the president, and Jerry ended up leaving. But and then we also decided that, you know, we needed a deep-pocketed partner. Pioneer didn't seem to be that willing to do that. They wanted the collaboration, but so that's when Dow Chemical.
Yeah, you did try to talk to them about that.
Oh yeah, yeah. And Dow Chemical ended up making an equity investment in us, getting on the board, and they wanted a little window on biotech. They had a good size and very successful agrochemical business, but they saw the threat of biopesticides.
Was this their first foray into this? Or?
I think it was. It was certainly their most significant, if it wasn't their first. So that gave us a pretty big gorilla there. But then Dow got more and more involved, ended up buying, got to a 40% ownership position, and sort of forced Jerry out. there, and then they took a 50% position. Maybe that's when he got out. And then they ran the company as a majority shareholder. Carl Leibowitz was the president. They ran it for a couple of years until they bought the whole thing.
Yeah. So what did that mean for you at that point? You're talking, you must have had discussions with Jerry.
Yeah, I decided to stay on just because I had, you know, we're still doing some interesting things in terms of collaborating with different companies. We're looking at buying some seed companies. I was running the biopesticide business at the time, which was small. We had acquired a little company in Salinas Valley called SoilServe, which was about a $30 million business. Applied pesticides.
With the locally?
Yeah,
regionally?
Regionally there on vegetable crops. It's a real big vegetable area, lettuce, side crops. So we were thinking we were going to be able to get a lot of our products applied through there. It didn't turn out that way. We got some, but not a lot. So that was an interesting asset, and we were... I had been involved in a number of deals. We had Japanese investors. Japan Tobacco was an investor. We had a collaboration with them. Kubota was an investor. They had the Japanese rights to our biopesticides. Those were deals I had worked on. And well, the other person I didn't mention was we had, several other people. We ended up having a pretty good executive team at Mycogen. Jim Glenn was our chief financial officer, and he came to us out of Lubrizol when we bought, before we bought all of AgriGenetics, right as we were doing our initial public offering, he joined us as our chief financial officer. And he and I were responsible for doing a lot of the different deals. We did a lot of acquisitions and collaboration agreements. And so I'd worked with Jim. We had Al Kern joined out of Monsanto. We worked with or for Jerry at Monsanto. He was our commercial development person. And then Leo Kim we hired out of Shell, his biotech group. He was a head of research. So I was one of the five executives at Mycogen for a number of years. So it was very interesting stuff. We hired Joe Panetta as our regulatory guy.
Oh, I didn't realize
that.
Yeah,
and he was... I forget where he came from. It was a chemical company back east, pesticide company. And so he really cut his teeth on the whole biopesticide, biotech thing at Mycogen, and it translated in him being head of bio here for years. So he was a really good guy. He did a lot of pioneering stuff with the EPA, getting our CellCap product that registered, first genetically engineered product the EPA ever registered.
I should go talk to him.
Oh, you should,
About this and
right.
As well as other things.
He has the regulatory side now. Cole, I'm sure he still remembers that really well. So we had a good team of people there. So I stayed on until Dow's ultimate acquisition, and then they offered me a job back in Indianapolis, which I didn't want to do, and so I left at that time.
Yeah.
And I still had equity position, so I was financially pretty well set after that. But it was quite a ride. It was 16 years there, and we did lots of things. We had five rounds of private equity. We had three public offerings, initial public offering, two follow-ons. We did a bunch of acquisitions, a bunch of joint ventures, a bunch of collaborations. We had went through the whole process of having a major minority shareholder become a majority shareholder, and then we tried to force the ultimate acquisition because we just want to sit there with them owning 60% of the company. We didn't want to sit there forever, so we...
Even though that's going to make... That would mean big changes for you personally. And
we all had... I had some founders' shares left still, obviously, but that 10% was a lot less than that by the time we got acquired, clearly, with all that equity dilution. But everybody saw the handwriting on the wall. They weren't, I would say, happy working under Dow's organization and framework. It was a huge company that had all the systems.
And they were changing things for you operationally.
Right.
Yeah.
So, we were used to making decisions. You get five guys together, we make a decision, and go.
Not as much fun.
Right, it wasn't much fun. Yeah. So it was, but it was a very unique experience, I think, just going through that whole thing. The timing, timing is everything. The venture capital was available at the time. We started, biotech was just getting started. It was a sexy technology. I was in the right place at the right time. And,
And what were your thoughts at that time about what you would do next? Have you been retired since 96?
No. I'm getting these things confused. As soon as I left there, I was going to retire for a while anyway, but then Jerry contacted me,
Milo said.
He was on the board of this little company, Milo's, which was ironically leasing space there in the Mycogen complex that Dow took over. So I knew it was there. I didn't really know what it was doing or anything. And they were having a problem between their founder and John O'Brien, who was a university professor.
John O'Brien is the founder?
He was the founder. He came up with the prosaptide, the peptide that had neurotrophic properties. Came out of his research at UCSD, and they licensed that, and that was the basis of Milo's. It was all it was. And they had a president in there, and they had some scientists in the lab, and they were developing that as a drug. And so, but the president and John O'Brien got crossways over some stuff. John was a difficult guy to deal with.
And was this before or after Jerry called us?
Well, I think Jerry came in probably to help try to smooth things out, I think. But he was there while they were having the problems, and I just came to the conclusion they were not resolvable, so they ended up terminating the president, and they're looking for someone else. And Jerry said, "Well, I know this guy, Andy Barnes, just became available here." And so I got sucked into that, Jerry. But it was interesting, and I got back in the pharmaceutical side of things, and had a chance to run. You know, I was be the president, making the decisions there. They had Vanguard Ventures was on the group now. Not David Rambler's new partners, younger partners, but so they were investors as well as several other firms. And so, and they had a drug that was had started a phase 2 clinical trial. Maybe it didn't start till after I was there, but it had completed phase 1. I think it was going into phase 2. So we ended up doing a phase 2 trial on it, and the results of the trial were, well, it was for treating neuropathic pain associated with diabetic neuropathy. You know, you get pain in the feet and the knees. And so the results of the trial were mixed, I would say. They weren't statistically significant if you looked at the overall population, but if you looked at a subset of the population, they're pretty compelling. There's nothing out there to really treat this disorder.
And, so how was the FDA looking at results like that at that time? This is before. Maybe they've changed now. Everything's
personal. Well, everybody was, well, they don't like that when you go back and review your data after the fact. They like when you establish the endpoints up front, and you either meet them or you don't meet them. So it was a difficult situation. The venture investors were tired. They weren't really interested in putting any more money in. And so I was sort of chartered with figuring out something to do. And so we decided to see if we could partner or sell the company. Mm-hmm. And the partnering, we talked to lots of big pharma companies, small biotech companies, etc. You know, we had come up with what we thought was a fairly compelling story, but of course, I always had that issue with the fact that the results weren't statistically significant when you looked at the population at large. But if you looked at the population whose nerves weren't already dead or essentially dead before you, they were pretty robust.
Yeah.
So, to make a long story short, we were finally able to find a company, which is called Biotechnology General at the time. They've changed their name now. But they ended up purchasing the company, and we did a buyout where there was a certain amount paid up front, and then there was contingent payments based on the success of the drug going through the trials. Well, of course, we learned or reinforced the experience there that when you do that, you lose control of the trial. So they switched from diabetic neuropathic pain to HIV-induced neuropathic pain because they could get some funding from the HIV research group, so it was a lot less expensive. So they did that trial, and then they did not get positive results. So we don't know to this date whether the drug didn't work or whether it would have worked in the He's a diabetic for having pain. So, but the venture investors were happy. They got their money back, or maybe a little bit more, with the initial upfront payment. John O'Brien died shortly after that. Question whether he committed suicide or not. He suffered from polio, post-polio syndrome. He took the drug himself. He developed it and he treated himself. So he was a testimonial to the drug working because it relieved his pain now. And there's still some question at this point, the soundness of his scientific results, because he had so invested in it. I don't know to this date whether his bias, the fact that maybe he was being discovered by the trials not working as well, led to him taking his own life or not. It's all speculation.
Yeah.
But anyway, I wouldn't publish that.
Sure.
But, so anyway, that was a success. Only I was like a minor hero to the investors because I got money back there.
So they'd be willing to back you on something else. But at that time, what happened?
Well, at that time I retired, I believe.
Yeah. What was the year?
Well, that's a good question. Micogen was 96 when that bought out. So. A couple years of my list. It was late 90s, 98, 99, probably. Yeah, probably. So I retired for a year and a half, was playing golf and doing some traveling, and my kids were still in high school and stuff, so I was spending some time with them. But I got introduced to a woman that used to work for me at Milos, Charlotte Clark, a friend of her father's. Was working with these medical device engineers who had developed a device for injecting drugs without using needles, needle-free injection system for self-administering drugs.
Yeah.
And I was intrigued with that because Herceptin at Milos was an injectable, and that was one of our challenges, was it was going to be injected, and that was going to limit the market. A lot of drug companies were turned off about that right away, because they'd rather have it be a pill or something. So I saw the device. They had a prototype made up and everything. It was clever technology, and the patents were issued. And so I started kind of a part-time thing with them, helping them out, and then I kind of got sucked into the president of that little company. And so I ended up staying there for 5 or 6 years. I thought it was going to be like a year thing. And the initial technology didn't pan out because it wasn't reliable enough. You need to get a drug in essentially 100% of the time, particularly if you're doing an expensive biotech drug. Maybe a dose is $500. You know, you don't want to leave a drop on the surface or have a failed injection. And also it caused bruising, more bruising than a needle, surprisingly so. And you could feel a little pain, but it had a lot of promise early on, but only after we did a lot more testing that we found this out. But it turned out there that we were able to salvage something there because we came up with an alternative. A lot of drugs are delivered as pre-filled syringes now. Embril from Amgen is an example. You know, they get a pre-filled syringe, you take out of the refrigerator, let it warm up, and then you inject yourself and throw it away. Throw it away properly in a medical waste container. So we had come up with a technology, a fully automated way of taking a pre-filled syringe that had the needle on it, but snapping it into a cartridge, or in our device, which was about the size of an electric toothbrush, and then the patient would never see the needle, put it up against their skin, press a button, motor would insert the syringe, insert the needle at the proper speed, another motor would deliver the drug at the proper rate, when it was complete, it would retract the needle, and then tell you it's all over with, and then we just pop the cartridge out of the device and you throw it away. And it was already in a containment device, so the needle was never exposed. So it was very clever, and we developed a working prototype of that.
And you're on that patent too, right?
I'm on one of, there's several patents around that. I'm not a key inventor on that. The engineers did the invention there. So we ended up selling that to a biopharma company who wanted to use it to deliver their own drugs. I'm not at liberty to say who it is, but...
You're not.
Well, I signed a confidentiality agreement. They haven't commercialized it yet.
I see.
So this has been 2.5 years now. So whether they're ever going to or not, I don't know. But it was a large, major biopharma company. And, I don't know if the agreement's run out or not yet, but I'd rather not.
Sure.
Say that. So that was kind of interesting. It was a whole medical device experience, but it was frustrating because the initial technology didn't pan out. But there we got our money, investors' money back again there. And we were looking like we were going to get nothing there for a while. It wasn't that much money, but there wasn't a huge amount. It wasn't like a pharmaceutical.
Yeah. Well, how does that feel when it looks like this might be a total loss? And you're sort of...
Well, I didn't like it at all because these guys, the investors here, were people that I kind of brought in. There was John Patience and Jack Shuler. Jack Shuler's former CEO of Abbott. My father worked for him, but he's been a very successful investor. He was on Amgen's board early on. He's on the board of Medtronic, has been for quite a while. What was the name of the company? He sold his company that was out in Tucson, got bought by Roche. It was a diagnostic company. Hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, he's a very successful guy. So they had invested because of my contacts with them. So that's what you don't like. And we had some other investors, I think. I forget about that. You have people you know that have put money in because you were involved in the enterprise. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have them lose money. You'd like to see them make lots of money, but it doesn't always happen. But I think I can safely say that of the four companies I'm involved with, nobody lost money. Micogen, they clearly made money. Zymos, I think, clearly investors made money there, too. But
That's a nice track record.
Yeah, wow, yeah,
lots
it is.
Of people.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's hard. I mean, I think the key thing I realize is timing is everything. And you gotta be lucky. You can be as smart as you can, and you know, work as hard as you can. But some things just don't work out because the timing's not right, or somebody else does something that preempts you, or whatever. So you gotta be lucky, and you've gotta have good timing. So it's very, I think. It's always surprising to me that people think because they were successful in one startup venture, they're going to be successful in another. Now, I know people have, but it's
always risky business.
It's always risky business, right? Yeah.
And you are now fully retired?
I am.
And seriously golfing?
I'm a professional golfer. I play $5 Nassau's 5 days a week. So.
Yeah, good.
It's not very lucrative, but... Yeah, I don't really have a desire to get back involved. I mean, I would probably do some consulting, but advising if somebody was supposed to ask me, but I haven't been asked of anything. I've looked at some things, but I don't really want to get sucked back into doing something on a full-time basis. Like the last, Avant Medical was the little medical device company, and yeah, that was just too much work for too little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the end of the day, I was hung in there until the end just to see if we could get people's money back out of it or make something out of it. Fortunately, we did.
Great. And anything else that you can think of that did we skip over anything?
Oh, I'm sure we did, but. Not that I can think of. I mean, I was obviously in the right place at the right time with the technology licensing office thing at Stanford. I mean, that was a great opportunity for me, and I happened to make the right choice to do that. I remember agonizing over it. It was, you know, it wasn't the flashy thing. Everyone else is going with big companies or venture firms, and here I'm staying at the university. And, you know, it didn't pay that well and all that, but it was a matter of being patient. And I remember something that Fitz Johnson told me in the venture group, or told the class, was that the key in not just in venture capital, but he thought about in your career was making sure you put yourself in the deal stream. which was, I mean, put yourself in a position where you'll see a lot of opportunities. And that's what he needed to do as a venture capitalist, and that's what I think the technology licensing office job did for me at Stanford. It put me in the deal stream. I saw a lot of different companies, and the interaction with AlphaTest led to the Simogenics thing, which led to Vicogen ultimately, and Cable House was investors there, and
It is about making those connections,
right,
and being involved in that market.
That's what people have asked me going to Stanford Business School, you know, what I take out of that. And, you know, it was a very good program. I don't dispute that. But I'm not sure the classroom stuff was any better than other schools. But you're in the deal stream there. You're in Silicon Valley. You have venture capitalists all around. And you have classmates that are really high power, high caliber people that are going to do things or have done things that, you know, you can benefit from being exposed to. So that was a little bit of putting myself in the deal stream as well. So I think a lot of kids today, they want to expect they're going to have the ultimate job right out of college or something, and it doesn't always work that way. You got to take some things just to put yourself in a position to get exposed to the good job.
Listen, you were here in San Diego for all those years with Micogen,
right,
and these other, Milos is here, was Avant?
Yeah, he was here too.
Okay, so you've been here the whole time,
right,
and you've seen this particular region grow up. While this was happening, what were your thoughts about that? I mean, you know, maybe somebody like Jerry is more involved in it, but, you know, he's doing the civic stuff, but...
Yeah, I didn't do. Jerry was our front man, kind of intentionally. He's good at it. He wanted the CEO to do it, and it benefited Micogen to have their name out there. Well, it's been very impressive to me. Obviously, we did not use the university structure here that much for Micogen.
So how was it?
Clearly, Milos was based on it, but we didn't use it that much. But a lot of other companies have. You know, there wasn't the ag base here that ag research did.
Yeah, were there better places to do an ag company? Or
well, Davis might have been a little better, but, you know, we needed to have the molecular biology biochemistry talent, and we could access that here from the lab. And it was a great place to recruit people in from, you know, we wanted to hire an entomologist or a plant pathologist, getting to come and live in San Diego was a real positive, as opposed to Mississippi or someplace in New Jersey or wherever. But the other thing that spun out of Micogen was our fermentation technology, because when Dow took it over, that was one of the assets. It wasn't a prime interest of theirs, but one of the ones they kept. And this was a fermentation group that's run by a guy named Hank Talbot here. And they spun that out into a separate company. Because what they had done, or we had done, was we had become really good at genetically engineering and producing proteins in Pseudomonas, which is a different cat than E. coli. Had some advantages there, and we had developed a system where we could, you know, grow the cells up to very high cell density and then initiate expression so the protein would be expressed at large masses of the protein in the cell, and then we could harvest the fermentation. So Dow's thought was we could use that to produce other proteins besides BT, and so they kept that as a private company that's, well, as a division of Dow, and then they spun it out into a private company that's still here in San Diego.
Huh.
And
what's it called?
Well, I'm going to tell you here as soon as I find the... Hank Talbot is a key scientist there. It's called Phoenix. PFENEX, which is Pseudomonas fluorescens, PFE, Phoenix. And so they are contracting now with companies, pharmaceutical companies, to produce, you know, potential drugs in this system.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a number of advantages. They sequenced the whole Pseudomonas fluorescens genome, and they know everything about it. It's a very high efficiency system. And we had when I was involved in managing the group, Hank was running it. You know, our interest was producing as much BT protein as we could, because we were in our cell cap system. We had to compete with Abbott, who was a big, they were the leading BT producer. They had a biopesticide division.
Abbott
did. Because they had excess fermentation capacity, same reason Noble got into it. They had fermentation capacity left over from the production of their antibiotics and other drugs.
When did they do that?
They were in it before we were. They were the leading producer of BT. They and Sandoz were the two big BT producers in the U.S., well, probably in the world.
So did you know about Abbott doing that before
no.
you got...
No, it was only a way for them to fill fermenters. They also produced a substance called gibberellic acid, which is a fermentation product that used to treat table grapes. Table grapes grow all clustered, and if you treat them with gibberellic acid, the grapes separate out, and they're not all stuck together if you don't treat them. Sometimes you buy a bad acid, they weren't treated properly, and they're all kind of, all the grapes are mushed together, but if you treat them with gibberellic acid, it's a growth regulator. Anyway, it's a very high-value product. Abbott dominated that market and sold it. I think they're out of that business now. But so we had to compete with them economically, because we didn't have 80% gross margins on biopesticide products like might have had 50 or 60%. We needed to be economic. And so we had developed a very efficient Pseudomonas system, I guess, at one point. And so Dow recognized that and continued that group going. And now it's a separate company that raised private equity. And it's, I don't know how, I haven't talked to Hank in over a year, but I don't know how they're doing. It was something that spun out of the Mycogen. And Dow still has Mycogen Seeds as their trade name for their seed business. I know that because I'll watch a Purdue basketball game sometime on the Big Ten Network, and they'll have an advertisement because it's coming back there for Mycogen Seeds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, thank you, Andy. Great story.
Yeah, that's a long-winded one there, I guess.
No, that's good. And we'll put a transcript together and get it back to you. You can review it. We'll be incorporating it into we're writing stuff. We've got the magazine. We've got a book.
Yeah, the magazines. Is it gonna, the book going to be kind of a companion to the magazines?
Is that the book is going to be the story of the origins of commercial biotechnology.
Right.
So Mycogen is part of that. In 1982, getting the ag thing started. So that's...
Yeah, it was interesting. I don't have a recollection of all of it, but I remember when I was marketing the Cohn-Boyer for Stanford, there was a conference back at Cold Spring Harbor that I was attending and giving an explanation of a license, and there was researchers there. And I think there may have been a little pushback from them at the time, now I think about it, but I remember riding from the airport out to Cold Spring Harbor in a limo or car. I was this young guy just out of Stanford to hear these famous scientists. I don't recall who they were, but it was somebody like Watson and Crick and those guys, they were going out to this meeting.
Wally Gilbert
was there, so it was kind of fun. Some of the guys that they weren't colleagues of mine, but I did interact with them a little bit back in those days, and they became kind of the foundation of biotech, think about it.
So the book is about them, but you'll be in it too.
Well, George Rathman's a huge story.
That's
I'm sure you knew him. Huge success. He's a great guy. I ran to him over the years at bio conventions and things. I often wonder if I would have hung on and hooked up with them, what would have happened there.
Yeah, well, you could have gone lots of different ways.
Yeah.
You could have gone Amgen. Actually, it's interesting that Amgen started, because they were talking to Bill Watson. Did you recall any
I wasn't. They were just talking about scientists. I didn't know which ones. I just knew the guy. I met the guy out of UCLA. I interviewed with him when I was down to Thousand Oaks with George Rathman. I wasn't that excited about Thousand Oaks because there wasn't any sailing right there. I was a big sailor at the time. Seattle was fine. San Francisco was fine. San Diego was fine.
Thousand Oaks, not, I guess there's no good harbor there.
Yeah, I was a small boat. I race sailboats. Small boats. there's no small boat racing out of that harbor, whatever that harbor is there. Yeah, yeah, across the hills there's a harbor there. But,
yeah.
So I probably entered into my thinking a little bit. Yeah, it would have been interesting. George would have been a fun guy to work for. Different character, a character like Jerry Calder. I mean, they're similar.
Guys. Yeah. No, lots of great stories. For historians, it's really rich territory.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get interested in this? Or?
Well, I was in the history science program at UCSD, and actually, I can remember I was in a meeting with one of Mary Walsh, the extension person who's been involved. I went to talk to her. I said, you know, I want to do something local. I remember I used to go down Torrey Pines and see advanced tissue science and stuff.
Yeah.
Just curious about it. What are they doing in there? And when I talked to Mary, I said, what are the stories here? I want to do local research. She said, well, you should do either the Qualcomm story or the Hybridtech story.
Right.
And so I thought about that. I ended up choosing Hybridtech. I'm not exactly sure why, but that turned out great.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of research on Hybridtech. Yeah. Got to know all those people.
Yeah, that was an interesting... I didn't interact with David Hale when he was there, but subsequently, I mean, we talked with him a number of times. Martha Demski was the one I remember that helped me out in the early days. Who was the initial... Ted Green was... He was there, right? He wasn't just an investor.
No, he was really early, yeah.
Yeah, he was. Oh, there was another guy. Yeah, they had that Lilly connection.
Right. Yeah.
That's funny because we had an interacting with Lilly because they, Dow AgroSciences, you know, they ended up buying Lilly's ag business. And Dow bought that. And, so there were Lilly people there that came out of Lilly over to Dow and ended up dealing with, you know, it's a small world in life sciences.
Yeah. It's interesting.
All right, I'll let you go here.
Thank you, Andy.
All right, well, sure. Enjoyed it.
Pleasure to meet you.
Jogging my mind here. So
all right, remember this. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, I assume you have a copy of the Stanford license. And the,
I do have that stuff.
I still have some of that stuff in a file.
Okay, so I'll make sure you're on our mailing list.
Okay, yeah, I appreciate that. I read those.
And we're actually be having some events down here, bringing people together for stuff.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. Next year we'll have a book coming out on Hybridtech, so
oh, really?
A little book launch party.
Oh.
We'll invite you to that.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So, you start out with yes and no. I did is that you